For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Scott Morgan. Ladies and gentlemen, what a fight we were waiting for. The Senate race so big, so consequential, that even Al Jazeera ran a story about how South Carolina might just flip from red as a bullfighter's cape to blue as a Billie Holiday song. But while we were all strapped in expecting the thriller in Manila, what we ended up with was a Mike Tyson beatdown with a $200 million budget. All the polls heading into Election Day either gave Republican Senator Lindsey Graham a slight edge or gave a much ballyhooed Democrat challenger named Jamie Harrison a slighter one. Some polls called for a dead even race. When it was over, Graham had won the typically 10-point red state of South Carolina by 10 points. Post-bout, Graham took a victory lap that included one particular pot shot.
To all the pollsters out there, you have no idea what you're doing.
Ouch. Meanwhile, all the rest of us in the peanut gallery, who'd been expecting a recount by now, were left asking again, how did the polls get it this wrong? Again. Well, buckle up. This is going to get complicated.
Jamie Harrison had to have people who were going to vote for Trump vote against Graham, and that was very unlikely.
Scott Huffman is the director of the Winthrop poll at Winthrop University, where he's a professor of political science. We spoke on Zoom.
So I think the trend was correct that Graham was ahead, but I think things began to break in the last 2 weeks of the election.
I'm honored and humbled to appear before you today as a nominee for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. I thank the president.
The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, the third conservative justice of the Trump administration to the Supreme Court, could not, Huffman says, come at a more fortuitous time for Graham, who just so happened to be the guy in charge of the Senate hearings. That gave him immense exposure in October of an election year in the very same arena where he won over leery conservatives a couple years earlier during the Brett Kavanaugh nomination.
Graham did exactly what the hardcore Republicans, who now like him but used to dislike him, he did exactly what they wanted, which was go back on his word and push through a conservative Supreme Court nominee. So that sort of reminded the people who were, you know, like, oh, well, I don't know if I'm going to vote for Graham. That reminded them, oh, yeah, that's why I want to keep a Republican in the Senate.
That might explain the late turn in Graham's favor, something that did show up in the last few polls, giving him a more comfortable lead than that 1 or 2 points he'd been carrying. But over the life of summer to fall polling, there was likely something more fundamentally wrong with the polls themselves.
It used to be the case that the people who would talk to us and the people who would not talk to us would be basically the same in their proclivity to vote for a Democrat or vote for a Republican. But now that's no longer true.
Stephen Miller is a political science professor who runs the Palmetto poll at Clemson University. We also spoke on Zoom.
There is a segment of the U.S. voter population that we will call a low trust population. They don't trust the media. They don't trust us. They don't trust polls or whatever, so they don't talk to us, which means they don't appear in our sample, but they're way more likely to vote Republican.
Pollsters fill gaps in samples with statistical weights, numbers meant to balance out where they know they're missing a certain portion of the overall picture they're trying to draw. And while an easy answer to counterbalance the low-trust people who won't talk might be to just add X points to the right-hand side of the polling equation,
the problem is we don't know what percentage of the population is not talking to us because they are low-trust.
Those people not answering calls from pollsters might just be people not answering an unfamiliar number on their phones. So you can't just chalk them all up to being likely Republican voters. And then there's voter engagement, which, judging by our neighbors to the north and south, seems like it counts for a lot when measuring the accuracy of a poll.
In Georgia, you had two Senate races, but you also had, you know, folks like Stacey Abrams, you know, going out beating the bushes, making sure there would be high turnout. In North Carolina, you had one Senate race, not to mention Cunningham shooting himself in the foot there at the end with the sexting scandal that turned into the affair scandal.
Those races and their polls are illustrative because in Georgia, where engagement was high, the polls showing how the Senate races would shake out were almost exactly correct. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, Republican Senator Tom Tillis won a narrow re-election bid over Democrat Cal Cunningham, who had been picked by every reputable poll to win by at least 5 points. In South Carolina, a state no one really thought Donald Trump was in any danger of losing, voter engagement was modest. And that translated down ballot to a poll that was off by quite a few points from what actually happened. And if fortuitous timing with the Supreme Court, strong ties to a president who's popular in this state, non-representative population samples, and modest voter engagement in South Carolina weren't enough already to explain that poll versus reality gap, there's the media role in all this.
what's important from a statistical standpoint is what gets lost in the message. And what gets lost is that there are bounds of uncertainty around the estimate that could be any number of plausible outcomes.
In other words, when a poll comes out, it's a whole lot more digestible to count to six than it is to try to explain all those little dots and lines and points that show other possibilities. Again, Scott Huffman.
One of the problems is the drive for profit in the media world. You've got to take a piece of information that is coming at you a million miles an hour and get it out in a way that grabs people's attention. That does not lend itself to analysis.
So part of the onus is on news agencies to dive deeper than counting the space between two percentage points. But Huffman says reporters and news consumers need to temper their expectations for what a poll really is.
People are treating polling as if it's modeling and prediction, and it's not. There are statistical models that are put together, of which opinion is a part. But models that predict outcomes are very different than polls. Polls are snapshots of one point in time. And if you're looking for prognostication, that's where you look to models.
The problem there is that if polls are an early high school class, statistical models are a graduate study. They are a lot more complicated than opinion polls taken over a phone, meaning
we're going to turn to models only insofar as pundits and reporters understand them and can describe them in a short and pithy way that the consumer can understand.
So what do we do about all this? Well, news reporters can get better at deciphering statistical models, for one thing. Stephen Miller says they can also get better at recognizing when they're getting played by polling companies whose aim is to produce wacky outlier polls as a way to gum up the averages and as a way to use dire-sounding news coverage as a means to fundraise for a particular candidate. News consumers need to learn to dig a little deeper themselves to understand how polls are conducted. And pollsters, Miller says, should probably start acknowledging that it's not 1975 anymore.
In the so-called golden era of public opinion polling by way of telephone or simple random number generation, you get a response rate of about 40%, maybe high 30s. But now the response rate for that type of sampling device is like 6%. And that's not good.
No, it isn't good, because it creates sampling biases that miss those in the low trust population, thereby tilting the polls more to the left than they should. And it creates the downward spiral of low trust in polls, leading to erroneous polls, leading to more distrust in polls, and a corresponding lack of interest in participating in them. So if the future is not by telephone, what is it by?
Probably the only path forward, given the fact that technology is rapidly changing on us, is that I think we need to shift more and more energies into getting more people online to take polls.
Miller says the reasons are simple. Online polls through large organizations like Alteryx pay a few bucks, for one thing, something that can help keep tabs on people who've already taken a poll, given that there'd be a payment record. Large companies could also sweep much larger samples. And
if I were to ask you something that's inflammatory, or the response would be inflammatory over the phone, you are more likely to withhold it than if I were to ask you that online, because if I were to ask you that online, there's this kind of perceived wall and more people feel more comfortable saying what they truly believe, even if it's really incendiary.
One last point is that all those polls predicting a photo finish for Graham and Harrison came from entities outside of South Carolina. The state's two main polls, the Winthrop and the Palmetto, were silent this year, each hampered by budget cuts due to COVID-19 response. Miller says that no one knows a state like its state newspapers, which ideally should be leading the conversation about public opinion in any state. But they have their own budget issues, too. For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Scott Morgan in Rock Hill.